Christopher Springman, and you're listening to Body Language. Have you had your dose of DSM today? Well, I'm speaking with Dr. Bridget Lank, a psychotherapist who knows a great deal about the DSM. In her role as the founder of the Lank Institute for Sexual Addiction and Recovery, Dr. Lank is a certified sex addiction therapist through the International Institute for Trauma and Addiction Professionals. Dr. Lank, it's nice to have you on Body Language.
Thank you, Christopher. It's nice to be here.
Okay, what's the DSM and why is a new edition coming out? And frankly, why should we care?
Well, the DSM translates, the DSM as a diagnostical and statistical manual of mental disorders. And currently we have the DSM-4 and a new proposed DSM-5 is coming out in May of this year. And basically what it does is it gives what we call maybe normal psychological functioning a way of classifying mental disorders or psychiatric disorders.
Oh, Dr. Lank used the word normal, and that's one of the reasons we use the word typical, and why people of, you know, different activist groups, for example, get very excited with the, is it the American Psychological Association?
Mm-hmm, the APA. Mm-hmm.
And the DSM. Of course, you're a member of the APA, but folks get all worked up because their conditions are frequently, at least in the past, have been defined in ways that they don't, well, they don't agree with. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, that they don't agree with are considered kind of normal, everyday stressors. You know, they're not necessarily a clinical disorder or diagnosis or a personality disorder, but for some reason, these behaviors or spectrums of behaviors or personality types become what's called pathologized. And they become diagnosable, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so things, you know, normal mood have different gradations to become a mood disorder or an anxiety disorder.
Well, wasn't there a moment in DSM history when homosexuality was considered a disorder? Is that correct?
Yes. Homosexual disorder, as it was called, you know, came out of the DSM probably in 1974, but it was pathologized in terms of it being a mental disorder or mental disease compared to what do they call normative behavior.
Sure. When did things change in terms of the DSM definition, or was that aligned with a change in public perception or all of the above?
I think it was all of the above. You know, I think the, and so that was changed in 74. We're also seeing gender identity disorder, you know, GID or gender identity disorder, shifting now. This is some of the proposed changes for May, where they are calling it now gender dysphoria, you know, which has more of a mood disorder around, you know, these people who to some extent may be closeted around gender identity. And there, you know, a lot of times these classifications or these diagnoses, Christopher, come in the symptoms, you know. And so people are diagnosing the symptoms, and in order to, gosh, have coding and record medical keeping, they will give a diagnosis. But we're seeing some shifts around sex and gender disorders. You know, sexual orientation was the first shift we saw. So now we're seeing gender identity, and there's a classification called sex and gender disorders.
Don't these definitions arouse insurance companies when it comes to reimbursement? What is the relationship between reimbursement and how a disorder is defined? I mean, you know, there is a financial component to this.
Yes, there is. And, you know, that's a good question in terms of what is a legitimate psychiatric disorder. A lot of insurance companies will need codings in order to bill, but they also need to see a pattern of behavior, you know, lasting for usually about 6 or more months, right? And they will really classify things around the mood disorders, for instance, or the anxiety disorders, or sleep disorders, or, you know, these Axis One, as they're called now, these areas that are of clinical concern. And so this is basically that someone is having some impairment maybe in their physical functioning or their psychological functioning or their employment or occupational functioning, where these businesses essentially might be losing money due to the unproductive work set of their employees. And so a lot of this managed care, if you will, sometimes may be generated by the insurance holders.
Our guest is Dr. Bridget L. Lang, PhD, a psychotherapist who practices in San Rafael, California. You can learn more about Dr. Lang and her work at her website, which is drlank at atnt.net. It has been said by some cynics that reimbursable conditions that are listed in the DSM are often a more, what's the correct term, popular diagnosis because of the financial aspect. Is there some truth to that, or is that just an urban legend or speculation on my part?
Well, it's really hard to know. I mean, certainly there are popular diagnoses that come into mainstream that we're seeing a lot of flare-ups and symptomology associated with, but I also think the psychopharmaceutical sales, too, in the treatment of these clinical diagnoses are actually sort of driving this train. And
oh, no kidding.
It's also...
Oh, sure.
Yes, and it's also quite difficult to know and to tease out. This is what makes the diagnostic criteria assessment process or multi-axial evaluation process so difficult, is because a lot of the symptoms or diagnostic criteria, as you call it, are on a spectrum of behavior.
So depending on what the DSM says and what is reimbursable and what is tied to pharmaceutical treatments, there are a lot of very, very interested players in the mix, aren't there?
There are. There are a lot of interested players in the mix who are treating symptomatically. You know, we look, psychologists, psychotherapists look at the larger picture of the behavior and the consequences, and certainly we're interested very much in the origin or the cause or the etiology of these symptoms. And I think a lot of the healthcare system is focusing on the back end of really the consequences. It's more consequence-driven.
So the American Psychological Association, your professional organization, will publish the DSM, is it 5?
DSM-5, that's correct.
In May, and do you expect the results, some of which have been leaked or previewed, to be, once again, controversial?
Yeah, I think they will be controversial. You know, I think it's been a slow-moving train, typically in the addition of it all. But I think one of the areas that I work with that the controversy around is hypersexual behavior, you know, and looking at it from a compulsivities place. These are some changes that we'll be seeing in the DSM-5, although they did just decide to not include the hypersexual behavior diagnosis.
Does that disappoint you?
It disappoints me somewhat. I mean, I think that, you know, it sort of delegitimizes it as a real live condition. Although we do see it manifesting, or compulsive behavior, a way a person expresses themselves sexually, in areas of sexual dysfunction, you know, desire, arousal, pain, or we see it as a subset of a substance-related disorder. You know, it doesn't directly fit addiction criteria, but it has enough similarities. And in the past, things around, you know, voyeurism or fetishism or even S&M, you know, this hypersexual behavior have been in the paraphilias. And now we may see it as a more of a function of sexual expression or obsessive compulsive personality, you know, more of a subset of preoccupation and thought.
You have been listening to Dr. Bridget Lang, psychotherapist who practices in San Rafael, California. She is the founder of the Lank Institute for Sexual Addiction and Recovery. Dr. Lank, thank you so much for joining us today on Body Language.